Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adask here on the financial survival. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James is more than competent speaker, writer, all right? And he's certainly one of the most knowledgeable people you're ever going to meet on an enormous number of subjects. Now, James, how are you doing?
I'm burning with embarrassment now, but yes, I'm doing pretty well, all things considered.
Are you embarrassed because of my introduction or embarrassed?
Well, it's very flattering, yes.
Weren't here last week.
Well, that too. Yes. No, I was extremely busy last week working on a new documentary that I just released at CorbettReport.com.
I understand. I understand. And it's going to be the main subject of the balance of the program, I think, is your video, 9/11 Trillions Follow the Money. What really surprised me about the video, I've watched it about 1.5 times. You narrate the video. And I assume you wrote the script for the video.
That is correct.
But who did all the, who assembled all of the video components? There are, you know, images of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. And I mean, there's scores of images. And I have a little bit of background in video, not much, but I know that's a chore. That's a project to assemble that. And I was wondering, did you do the video work?
Oh, you don't know the half of it when it comes to how much of a chore it was. I did not do the video editing on this one. That was all my friend Brock West, and he runs a blog called the Asia Pacific Perspective at apperspective.net. And he's in Australia, and so lately he's been doing a lot of the video editing for me, and literally without his help there is no chance that I would have been able to release this by the 9/11 anniversary. I'd still be working on it and would still be working on it for probably weeks to come. He definitely helped out with that. So yes, I can't take credit for that. The some of the clips that I use and things like that, of course, I compiled as part of my research, but the images and things, he really put together himself.
That's a chore. It's a one-hour video, and I have no idea how many clips are in the video. I'm going to guess that there are at least three a minute. 180, 200, 225. How many clips do you suppose compose that video?
That's probably a good estimate. I haven't counted them, but yes, it's an awful lot of footage.
Yeah, it's an amazing. And I just for what it's worth, I did a little TV on community access back in the 1980s, and we were going to interview people. And edit the interviews. And I realized right away, you do 1 hour video, you've had 3 hours of editing.
At the minimum, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I understand. It's not, I'm just talking about one subject. I'm talking, this other guy's talking. Just an incredible amount of work. And after that, I said, nope, we're doing these live. We're not doing any more editing.
Yep.
That's how you could develop an appreciation. The reason I bring that up is because, as I said, you have a great capacity to present ideas orally with your speech. You have a great capacity to write and present ideas that way. And I was wondering, is it possible that you're also astute, equally astute at preparing video? Because it's another language. It's another.
It is, yes.
I'm thinking, oh my God.
Well, I'm glad
you had told me that you'd done that video all by yourself. I would be singularly, I'd be amazed. I would be certainly respectful and.
Well, you should rewatch my Federal Reserve documentary. That one was all my own video editing, and that took 7 months to put together. So, yeah. Yes, you're exactly right. I'm glad you have that perspective because obviously a lot of people who haven't worked with video will not really appreciate that. But yes, it really is its own language, and it really does require a lot of thought goes into what images to use in what context, in what order to try to tell the visual narrative at the same time that the words are telling the oral narrative. And those things have to work together. It is, I mean, there's an awful lot of thinking and work that goes into that. So yes, I mean, you're exactly right about that. And yeah, 3-to-1 in terms of time spent editing versus the time on screen is the absolute minimum. In this case, I can't even tell you. I mean, Brock spent at least 50 hours, I'm sure, on the editing.
Begin with what you've done here. I mean, just, it's really very impressive. So we're going to tell people before we're done, we'll tell them where you can go see the video. 1 hour, certainly worth your time. And the subject matter, the title is 9/11 Trillions, Follow the Money. And the subject matter is an investigative journalist's report, that would be you, looking into 9/11, the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, looking into 9/11 and saying, this is a crime. Most important thing to understand about it is that it's a crime, and when you see a crime, one of the first things a good investigator should do is follow the money. Because crimes don't usually happen without a monetary impulse. Now, we've been led to believe this was something like a theological impulse because the Muslims allegedly committed the attack on 9/11. And what you're suggesting is no, it wasn't just theology and it wasn't just politics. This was about the money, and quite a lot of money. I think I saw the number $8.5 trillion that changed hands because of this attack.
Well, $8.5 trillion is to do with the Pentagon, which has not been able to produce a budget since 1996, when it was supposedly required by law to do so, because their accounting systems don't talk to each other, so they're unable to account for transactions. And so this came to a head in the fiscal year 1999. In the year 2000, the Inspector General released the Department of Defense's Inspector General released a report for fiscal year 1999, where they came to the conclusion that there were $2.3 trillion of transactions in that fiscal year alone that could not be adequately documented, to the fact that basically there were these transactions going on that there was nothing backing them up. So these presumably
was disappearing, but nobody knew why.
Well, exactly right. And of course, this doesn't mean that $2.3 trillion disappeared. It meant that $2.3 trillion worth of transactions aren't documented properly, which means that there is, of course, those spaces for billions and billions and billions to go missing. But no one knows exactly how much and in what manner and in what way. So it's not just a quick case of incompetence. I mean, I think we have to look at the corruption angle of a story like this. And unfortunately, it wasn't just $2.3 trillion in fiscal year 1999. And by the way, that's only the $2.3 trillion that the Department of Defense's Inspector General Office had the staff and time and availability to look through to determine that $2.3 trillion. There was another $1.8 trillion in transactions that they couldn't even check because they didn't have enough time and resources. In fiscal year 2000, there was a further $1.2 trillion that couldn't be accounted for. They didn't even try in 2001 to put a number on that figure because they couldn't. By 2013, a Reuters report had determined that over the past decade and a half now almost, it's been $8.5 trillion that now they can't account for. So the interesting part about this and the way that it ties into 9/11 is that this issue had been dogging Donald Rumsfeld, obviously the Secretary of Defense at the time, had been dogging him since his nomination for that post back in early 2001. And throughout the hearings and throughout the summer, there had been defense budget hearings that they'd talked about this missing money. And so this had come up several times, but on specifically on September 10th, 2001, Monday, September 10th, 2001, Donald Rumsfeld appeared at a briefing talking about a new war that he was launching, a war on the Pentagon's bureaucracy. And he went into this big speech about, oh, these accounting systems aren't working and they're not talking to each other, so we can't account for $2.3 trillion. But don't worry, we're going to wage this war on the Pentagon and things will change. And he even concludes, or he includes in that speech, the really momentous phrase. He says, you might ask yourself, how can the Secretary of Defense attack the Pentagon in front of its own people? But I say I'm not here to attack the Pentagon, but to liberate it. The next day, of course, the Pentagon was literally attacked, and of course it was hit in the west wing, the Wedge 1, which had just recently been renovated. And who had just moved into those offices there? Well, a section of the U.S. Army that specifically was working on the problem of the missing money. It's called Resource Services Washington. It was an office staffed with about 45 accountants, bookkeepers, and budget analysts, 34 of whom were killed in the attack on the Pentagon the day after Rumsfeld announced his war. And the army later, the chief of the army later had to come out and say they could not produce their own the Army Consolidated Financial Statement for 2001 because of the loss of financial management personnel sustained during the September 11th terrorist attack. And who was the chief of the Army at the time? Thomas White, a former senior executive at Enron. And of course, Enron was at that time in 9/11, at the time of 9/11, being investigated for the multi-billion dollar boondoggle fraud that it turned out to be. And where were the records of the Enron investigation being stored? At least partially so. They were being stored in World Trade Center Building 7, which on 9/11 collapsed into its own footprint at freefall gravitational acceleration without having been hit by a plane, the only large-scale office tower, steel-framed office tower in the world to ever fall due to fire, was World Trade Center Building 7, and the SEC did lose around 3,000 to 4,000 documents on active investigations, including the Enron investigation, in that destruction, but they can't tell, or they won't tell, via FOIA requests, what documents they actually lost. So, there's so many different things that you could branch out from there, but I think it's particularly interesting that one of the actual offices that was blown apart on 9/11 was Resource Services Washington, with their accountants, bookkeepers, and budget analysts.
It's not, well, first off, you are implying that there may have been an ulterior motive for 9/11, which was to conceal the loss of several $1 trillion from the Department of Defense. And if that's what you're implying, that certainly wasn't an objective for Osama bin Laden and his merry men.
Certainly not.
They didn't want to do anything to the Department of Defense. you're implying that somebody's doing this besides Osama.
Absolutely, that would be the implication if this line of reasoning does hold. And I should be very careful to say that I don't think this is the only reason, or even necessarily the primary reason, that an event like 9/11 happened. But it was, I think, something that definitely deserves further scrutiny than it's been given. And that, I think, the utter failure of the so-called fourth estate, the media, to actually do its duty and to actually hold these politicians' feet to the fire is exemplified by the fact that Donald Rumsfeld was not only, after 9/11, never asked again by the press about these missing trillions or unaccounted for trillions of dollars. He was actually accosted during the 2006 budget hearings, defense budget hearings, by Cynthia McKinney at that time, who was a congresswoman who did grill him about that missing trillions, although he evaded giving any substantive response. But he was never asked by the press about it again until, I believe it was 2010, when it was a group of citizen journalists at one of his speaking events for a book tour he was doing at the time that he was asked finally about this. And again, he just gave a standard response. Say, well, the money wasn't missing. We just couldn't account for it because the accounting software wasn't talking to each other in the right way, or some thing like that.
The money's not missing.
Well, that's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. We don't know anything at all what's happened to this $8.5 trillion.
It's not missing. We just can't.
Exactly. Because the Department of Defense's own Inspector General admits that a lot of the underlying entries had to be completely made up just to make the books balance, that there's literally nothing behind them. They just said, oh, there's this amount of millions or billions missing. Well, here's a ledger entry that will balance that. And it's not based on anything. So that is missing money, whatever kind of semantics you want to put on it.
We have, we're going to run out of, we're going to take a break here in about 2 minutes. But before we do, let's just mention Larry Silverstein, who had a 95-year lease on a couple of the World Trade Center buildings, which I understand he took out in 2001. and the buildings came down in 2001. And according to your report, if I quoted you correctly, he'd only put down about $14 million of his own money to get into these buildings, but he insisted on insuring them for $3.5 billion. Before it was done, he profited by $4.5 billion on the destruction of the world, the Twin Towers and Building 7.
Yes, and that's about right. And you might wonder how you can profit by $4.5 billion if you only took out $3.5 billion of coverage, despite the fact that the insurance coverage wasn't even finalized at the time of 9/11. There were only temporary contracts in place with a lot of the dealers and the reinsurers who had been brought into the deal, because it was such a monumental negotiation to try to get this $3.5 billion of coverage that Larry Silverstein's insurance broker had been working furiously for months at that point to try to get this nailed down. And that's why this case dragged on and on and on in the courts for years after 9/11 to try to figure out who owed what and to what extent and by what amount. But in the end, after several years of legal wrangling, he had already collected about $2 billion, and then he got a further $2.5 billion settlement to clear the insurance companies in the end. So he got $4.5 billion. And as you say, it was a $14 million deposit, basically, that he put down. He had a couple of real estate investors with him in the deal. Lloyd Goldman and Joseph Kerr put down $111 million. The rest was provided in a bridge loan by GMAC for several hundred million. So Silverstein Properties put down $14 million, walked away with $4.5 billion, and of course got the right to rebuild on the site with One World Trade Center, formerly the Freedom Tower, whatever they were calling it. So sometimes these horrific, horrible, devastating events can work out very well for certain people.
Well, Silverstein is the one where we've seen a video where he apparently talked about Building 7, and he said, okay, pull it. And there are people who interpret that as evidence that Building 7, he's the one, I'm sure you understand this better than I do, and you can correct me when we come back from commercials in a moment, but he apparently said, go ahead and pull it, and it fell down, right? Not because it was struck by an airplane or some Muslim fire or special fireworks or something. It was designed when they said, pull it, fall. You correct me on that when we come back. We'll take a couple of commercials right now, and I'll be back with James Corbett in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks, I'm Alfred Addis, here on Financial Survival with our guest, James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from thecorbettreport.com. When we broke for some commercials, I was attempting to remember, or perhaps as our former president would say, misremember, whether or not Building 7, Silverstein, the guy who said pull it, in relationship to Building 7. Do you know?
Yes, that's right. There was a PBS documentary in 2002 called America Rebuilds, in which he said, quote, I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. And I said, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is to pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and we watched the building collapse. So that quotation has been mined to a great degree by the 9/11 truth movement and its critics, who are trying to parse out what he actually meant by that statement. And so, of course, I think any person with just sort of average understanding of what's happening there and what terms are being used would say that certainly sounds like he's saying we should pull the building, i.e. we should destroy the building, and that decision was made to pull, and we watched the building collapse, i.e. the building was destroyed. That's what it sounds like. Now, the alternate interpretation, the one that Silverstein and his supporters say, is no, what he's referring to pull, he's saying we should pull the fire crews that are working in the building, we should pull them out of there, and so they did that, and then the fire brought the building down. That's the alternative explanation, and there's been a lot of back and forth on that. There's been other people saying, no, pull is a specific controlled or a demolition term. It doesn't mean to blow a building up, like is being alleged with WTC7. It means to literally pull the building down, using supports and cranes and pulling the edifice down. So So there's been a lot of sussing out of that. Personally, my take on this is, I think it's, of all of the things to say about WTC7 and the way it came down, which clearly did not come down just as a result of fire, as NIST claims, I think of all of the things to say, I'd say this is one of the weakest arguments, so I don't tend to focus on this quotation, but it is certainly interesting, especially interesting in light of one of Silverstein's supporters back a few years ago trying to defend this quotation against an attack, I believe, by Jesse Ventura, who was trying to make make something of it for his television show. Someone came out and said, no, I talked to someone who had been on the phone with Silverstein that day. He had phoned his insurance brokers to see if there was the possibility of destroying the building and on that day. But then it came down anyway, so they didn't have to worry about it. So there was already, Silverstein was allegedly, reportedly, on the phone that day, already trying to figure out if they could blow the building up. And lo and behold, it blew itself up for them. So there's a lot to say about that. But yes, I mean, clearly the thing to keep in mind is that, again, WTC7 is the only steel-framed office tower ever to fall from fire, and also the way in which it was supposedly fell, it has to do with a column 18 which supposedly failed, and the buckling of that brought down the whole building. Kevin Ryan, a former underwriter at Underwriters Laboratories, does an excellent presentation talking about the very specific mechanical details of the NIST presentation and why it's wrong, and that is absolute must-see for anyone who's interested in that. And then further on top of that, NIST, at the time they came out with their final report for WTC7, they came out with this computer animation of the way the building collapsed, and they said, look at this animation, this comes from our data and what we looked at, and look, it conforms almost exactly to what you see in the video of the actual demolition, case closed. The only problem with that being the actual data which they plugged into their model to get that animation of the collapse is classified. People have actually requested it. Researchers have requested that data and been told that they cannot release that data because it would jeopardize public safety to release the data, so they won't do it. So basically, they show this computer animation, this cartoon of the building collapsing and say, trust us, it all lines up, the math is all there, don't worry about it, this is the way the building collapsed. So, I mean, clearly there's something wrong with that story, and clearly WTC7, which was outright owned by Silverstein, who built it in 1986, kind of separately from the main WTC complex, I think, again, we have to look at Silverstein as one of the prime suspects in a case like that.
We talk about Marsh and McLennan, an organization that's involved with computer programs, if I understand, recall correctly. Richard Grove worked there. He stumbled into... There were some financial problems where tens of millions of dollars were not properly accounted for. He reported it. People told him, keep his mouth shut, just leave it alone, mind your own business. He was invited to a global conference call on 9/11. And because he was stuck in traffic, he didn't get there. If he'd been there, he would have been crushed when the building came down. And he said that he'd talked to three or four other executives that he thought he could trust at Marsh and McLennan, if I'm understanding and recalling correctly, and that they were at the meeting and they were killed.
That's,
how many,
yes,
dead,
correct,
bodies do you think we can attribute to 9/11 that aren't just people that happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time? Is there a longer string of potential murders involved in this thing, or at least mysterious deaths?
There certainly are. And I think the Marsha McLennan story would be one of the windows into that. Another one, actually, also to do with World Trade Center Building 7, could come from a whistleblower like Barry Jennings, who was heading to the Office of Emergency Management, which Giuliani had controversially placed in World Trade Center Building 7 on, I believe, the 23rd floor of that building. So Barry Jennings, who was one of the emergency managers for New York City, was headed to that office on the morning, and when he got there, found it was completely abandoned. He was going down the staircase to try to get out of the building, and there was an explosion that blew him back up the staircase from within WTC-7, not an explosion outside the building, an explosion inside the building, which is not part of the official story, and eventually was rescued by firefighters who managed, he broke a window and managed to get the attention of some firefighters that were down before, obviously, the even World Trade Center 1 and 2 had collapsed. And on the way out, he said he was stepping over dead bodies, which again contradicts the official story that there were no dead bodies in WTC-7. So again, very interesting window into more potential dead bodies that are unaccounted for from that day. But yes, the Martian McLennan story is a fascinating one. Martian McLennan is an insurance firm. It has 57,000 employees. In 2014, it had over $13 billion in revenue. And on 9/11, it occupied floors 93 to 100 of the North Tower, which was precisely the impact zone and precisely where the fires were raging. So Marsh & McLennan actually had their data center with all their servers on, I believe, the 95th floor. And 96, 97, 98 was where Marsh and its developers from a contractor called Silverstream Technologies was working on a revolutionary new technology for directly linking for electronic trading through paperless transactions, Marsh and some of its key clients, and the test project that was ongoing in the summer of 2001 was to link Marsh with AIG, of course, the one of the world's largest insurance firms, and quite famously became nationalized after the 2008 meltdown, and has always been tied in with the CIA and the OSS before it with Cornelius Starr, but that's another story. Anyway, Marsh & McLennan and AIG were working on this electronic link in the summer of 2001 through this contractor, Silverstream Technologies. The salesman for that project, the salesman from Silverstream who was selling this technology to Marsh, was Richard Grove. He was involved in this. And he did start to encounter overbilling from various contractors to Marsh. And he was going through this with some of the employees at Marsh. And he was going through this with some of the his employees or his bosses at Silverstream. And he was shut down in both offices. Both the Marsh executive he went to and the Silverstream executive both said, don't worry about it. Don't look into it. Stop poking your nose around. He started to raise this with some other Marsh staffers who also had concerns about this and what was happening here, why there was this overbilling was going on. These particular staffers ended up, they were going to confront this executive in a meeting that was being held on 9/11, except, of course, they never got the opportunity to do so because, as I say, they were meeting in Marsh's offices right there in the midst of the exact midst of where the explosion happened. So they, unfortunately, they all ended up dying, all of the people that Richard Grove was working with. Now, the person, the executive that they were going to confront was not attending that call in person. He was attending from his apartment on the phone. And again, the details of this global conference call were confirmed in 2006 by the chief information officer of Marsh & McLennan at the time, a woman named Ellen Clark, who was talking about being on that conference call and listening as the line went dead and finding out that it went dead, unfortunately, quite literally. So a horrific story that gives another window into one of the financial anomalies, because it was later discovered from the wreckage of the World Trade Center, a number of hard drives were recovered, which were then sent by the FBI to Convar in Germany. And Convar is a European data recovery expert firm that uses, at the time, it was cutting-edge laser technology to recover information from damaged hard drives. And they were working on this problem, recovering data from the hard drives that had been charred to a crisp in the World Trade Center explosion and destruction. And in December of 2001, it was reported by Reuters and by an IGN news service report that got picked up by Fox News and others that they had started to discover over $100 million in anomalous transactions that had been running through the systems at the various financial services firms in the World Trade Center right before and right during the attacks. All of these transactions were taking place, an extremely anomalous, unusual spike in transactions. And one of the quotes from the people at Convar was saying, yes, it may be possible that suddenly everyone in America went on a wild shopping spree that morning, but it wasn't just the volume of transactions, but the size of these transactions were completely anomalous and very much an open question at the time where these $100+ million of transactions were coming from, where they were going. They were Convar was on the case of recovering this data, and they were never heard from again. The FBI took over the investigation, and now, although Convar talks about their work, you can watch their promotional videos where they brag about recovering this data, but a Convar spokesman a couple of years ago for a Dutch television interview would only say, yes, we reported what we reported at the time, and we stand by what we reported, but we cannot talk about anything that was anything that we uncovered, and we can't say anything more about this case. And that's where it lies, because the FBI, of course, isn't saying anything about the Convar investigation. So we know there were anomalous transactions that were happening at the exact time of the attacks on 9/11. We don't know where they were coming from, where they were going, where this money was going, but we do know that AIG and Marsh were working on this exclusive e-link at the time of 2001. And we do know that from Michael Rupert that someone in Deutsche Bank, who is another client of Silverstream with this e-link technology, had that a banker in Deutsche Bank who managed to escape the buildings did say that there was something that was taking over their systems on that morning right before the attacks began that they couldn't identify. They didn't know where it was coming. There was a massive data purge and a massive data transfer. They didn't know where it was coming from. They could not do anything at their terminals in Deutsche Bank to stop it from happening. And then the buildings started to explode. So again, another extremely interesting, horrific, macabre story of what was happening at the time of 9/11 that has never been followed up by any of Reuters or any of the other services that were covering it at the time. It's just gone down the memory hole.
You've provided an enormous amount of data. You've really collected a surprising and really almost amazing amount of data and compiled it into the video, and yet you come to the end of it and there's no conclusion. And I'm wondering, is that because a conclusion is impossible without verification from people in positions of power? I mean, if you collect all this evidence, and it is evidence of a crime, do you need an indictment and a conviction before you have a conclusion for your video? Or is any conclusion possible?
Well, I would say that what I'm doing is laying out all of these different pieces of the puzzle. And as you say, there's links to dozens and dozens and dozens of different documents and court documents and FOIA requests and all of these things that are in the transcript for this video that people can go through for themselves. But at the end of this, ultimately, there's so much information that is being kept from the public, deliberately so, as in the case with the WGC7 model data, or with the case of the Convar investigation and things of this sort, that we do not have access to from the outside, and we cannot get into that. We cannot get into the Pentagon's, you know, internal accounting systems to track where these transactions were coming from and who was making them and things like that.
We can't have a conclusion unless the government cooperates. So that's essentially, I think that's what you're saying.
The conclusion, yes. So the conclusion in terms of convicting someone in a court of law for this is not going to come without some sort of way into this through subpoena power and getting people to testify on the record and things of that nature, which obviously we in the public can't do. However, I would say that convicting them in the court of public opinion may be the more important point that we can get through the propaganda that way.
Let me ask you one last question. Where can people find a copy of the video that they can watch?
It is available on YouTube under the title 9/11 Trillions. Just type that into the YouTube search. Or it's on my homepage, CorbettReport.com. It's available for free viewing. And not only that, but the transcript with all of the sources, all source documents that I used, is there on the website at CorbettReport.com. It's 100% available for free. I hope people will get it, watch it. If they like it, please spread it around to other people. Raising awareness of these issues around 9/11, I think, is probably as important as any of the other issues that have been well explored, I think, by the 9/11 Truth Movement so far.
All right, James, I have to thank you for your time. As always, enjoy the interview. Hope to see you again next Thursday or next Wednesday, excuse me. We got to go, though. We're out of time. Thank all you folks for listening. Hope you'll tune in again. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, James, and Frank the producer. Good night.